Welcome to the Your Oxygen Mask First podcast. I'm Erin Young, and this is the space where we explore ways to help the helpers. Because you can't help anyone before you help yourself. So sit back, put your own oxygen mask on, and enjoy the ride. Imagine, if you will, the worst day of your life. You're standing on a bridge and contemplating whether or not to jump. Now imagine a kind soul behind you, beckoning you to come back and start a new chapter in your life. Could you still jump? We are honored to be joined today by one such kind soul. Kevin Briggs is a retired California Highway Patrol officer who's held his hand out to over 200 people who've tried to take their own lives by jumping off the Golden Gate Bridge. His compassion and talent for reaching desperate people during the most crucial times in their lives has earned him the nickname, the Guardian of the Golden Gate Bridge. And after 23 years in law enforcement, he's still touching people as an author, a speaker, and a consultant. Oh, and did I mention he's also a veteran? Thank you, Kevin, for joining us so much. I really appreciate it.
Well, it's an absolute pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
So tell us briefly about yourself and your background, and why did you choose a life of service?
Well, I think I chose it right from the beginning, out of high school, long time ago, 1981. I really didn't have a direction on where I wanted to go. So I looked at the different services and chose the Army, and 2 months out of high school, boom, I was in basic training at Fort Benning, Georgia, and I went into the infantry and then the airborne infantry. So I did 3 years in the military. I did a year up in Fort Lewis, Washington, and then I was transferred over to Germany, a little town called Gelnhausen. And my second year there, I was diagnosed with cancer. So I had an operation in Germany. Two more back in the States. They sent me back to San Francisco to the big hospital here, Letterman Army Medical Center. And I had two operations there and then several months of chemotherapy. I had testicular cancer I was diagnosed with at age 20. So that took kind of my career in a whole different path. But I got out of the military right about the same time I would have gotten out had I went full term and active duty. So it was something else. I learned a lot about myself in the military and a lot about other people, other races. So it was a fantastic experience. Of course, the cancer wasn't, but that's something to overcome also. And that brought all sorts of things about with depression and, you know, testicular cancer. That's affecting your manhood. And there's a whole lot of things that go into that. But out of the military and through this cancer process, after that, started to recover. And worked with my father. He had a printing business in San Francisco, which he did very, very well. I worked with him for a bit. And then I wanted to be self-sufficient. So I started applying to different jobs. One San Francisco Police Department. I did another one for State Corrections. And State Corrections picked me up. I started working at Soledad State Prison on January of 1987. And then I did my year down there. It's down by Monterey and Salinas. And then I was able to get back home in Marin County, where I'm from, which is just north of the Golden Gate Bridge. I got accepted and transferred to San Quentin State Prison. So I worked there for 2 years, where I learned even more about people working in a prison environment and about myself. Very, very interesting job. And then I was asked by one of my coworkers, a good friend of mine, to try out for the Highway Patrol, which he was doing. And I thought, I don't know, boy, that's tough. That's a tough job. Those guys always look real squared away. But I told him I'd do it with him. So we went through the process. I made it into the academy and graduated fourth. And he didn't make it, unfortunately. But this was I graduated in 1990 is when I started with the patrol. And went all the way up for almost 24 years, but up until November of 2013 when I retired.
And did you get to ride one of the cool motorcycles?
I did. I spent, I don't know, I'm going to say 10 years or something, or let's see. No, probably more than that on a motorcycle. I retired as the motor sergeant out of Marin County for the Highway Patrol. So that was really cool. That was a lot of fun.
So I'm going to skip around a little bit. What was the best part about being a police officer and a soldier? And what were the worst parts for you?
I think for me, just thinking about myself and what I realized, besides helping folks every day and all of that, one of the best things I ever did was get on that motorcycle, and being a CHP motor officer was really, really cool. That was a lot of fun. And it gave me access to a lot more things, being a whole different wavelength of things. We would do protective details for the presidents and all sorts of things like that because I was on the motorcycle. But it also helped me working because I worked on the Golden Gate Bridge a lot in responding to things. And I could get on these bridge sidewalks, which are about 10 feet wide, and get to places a lot easier than someone could in a car. And that helped a response time. On the opposite of this is stuff that really, really, I think, affected me was working with suicidal individuals and on occasion losing someone where they would jump off of that bridge. And the other part of that was seeing accident victims, little kids who were killed in crashes. You know, those things, they don't leave you. They're in your head. It's very, very tough.
Mm-hmm. So what was your worst story about the bridge? And then what was your best story?
I think the ones that I talk about were the ones that probably affected me the most, where I lost an individual that I had been speaking with for about an hour, a very, very intelligent young man. And he actually had flown out to California from New Jersey. And he was on the bridge. He was over the rail. There's an I-beam type deal there over on the other side of this 4-foot pedestrian rail. And he was sitting on that. And we were just calmly talking for about an hour. And he was not under the influence of anything. But he would just tell us, you know, emotionally, I need to be up there with you guys. But logically, you know, I need to be down there. And he'd point at the water. And he continually stared down at the water. And after about an hour of speaking with this young man who was well-versed in politics, religion, you name it, he was just an extremely nice guy and well-educated. He just suffered from a mental illness. But at the end, he just leaned to his right, and there he goes, 220 feet down where he struck the water. And I thought we were in the middle of this so-called negotiation, but he was ready, and he went. And then a couple of minutes later, a gentleman comes running up to me and said, "There's a body in the water." I'm like, "What the hell do you think I've been doing for an hour?" He goes, "No, another one." So we were in the middle of the bridge with this gentleman. Up at the North Tower, another man had jumped at about the same time. So we responded up there and threw out a flare marker, but that body was never recovered. It was hit by a ship. And on top of all this, we had lost another body about an hour and a half prior to all of this taking place that day. So that's unusual, and that's a very tough time for the officers and for myself as a supervisor. We hate to lose people on that bridge. You know, our job is to protect life.
That has to be the absolute worst day ever.
It was. And it's in our heads. You know, we see that. I see that guy. I'm talking to that guy. And then he goes. That was very, very tough. Mm-hmm. But on the other side of that, when you get the opportunity to speak to someone and they do come back over that rail. And there was a man that I spoke to for about an hour and a half. And his name was Kevin Berthia. And there's actually a photo of him that some people have seen. Is he standing over the rail by the North Tower? Just on this little bitty pipe, and that's all that was there. This cord that's on the other side of the bridge stops at the towers, and around the towers is just this little bitty pipe. But he had positioned himself on this little bitty pipe, and he wasn't even holding on to anything. He was very, very cold. He was wearing a white t-shirt and shorts, and it was so cold out there that he had one hand in his pocket and then his right hand in between his shirt and his body. And he was just kind of tripodding, had his 2 feet on the pipe and his head leaning in to the rail. You know, it was obvious he could care less what happened to him. But we spoke for about an hour and we talked about his life and how it had come to this point. And he had told me, you know, he had a daughter. And so I kind of focused on that. And what would his daughter think of him jumping? And there's a much greater chance of his daughter losing her life to suicide when she gets older. If he lost his life to suicide, we talked about her upcoming birthday and him not being there. And I didn't say something to the effect of, you know, how could you do this to your daughter? That's not right. And I don't want to do that. But I did say, well, how do you think your daughter will feel about this? You know, and then, of course, I mentioned the fact that if someone in a family loses their life to suicide, there's a much greater chance of other family members doing that also. So after going through all of this for an hour and a half, he decided on his own to come back over that rail. And I like people to do that on their own, because it takes a lot of courage to go over that rail in the first place. I think it takes even more courage to come back over that rail and face everything, because I don't try to fix anything. Usually there's nothing I can do, and I'm not going to lie to them. It's going to be tough. It's going to be rough, but you're alive and you get this opportunity. So it's just like a second rebirth. And when he came over, I asked him after I congratulated him, I said, what did I do that helped this situation? And what did I do that wasn't so good, that kind of hurt this situation? Because I wanted to learn, as I still do today. I want to see how I can better myself to help folks. And he told me, you listened. You let me speak and you listened. So when I do present to folks, I tell them, why does it take people to get up to this stage 4 cancer of a bridge before we start listening to them? Why can't we do it right here and right now? And that's important.
Do people come back to you years later, months later, and keep in contact with you and share how their life has progressed?
Generally not. And I really, not that I don't want them to, but I don't want them to do it for me or to say, hey, congratulations, you know, Kevin, you saved my life. Nope, I tell you, I didn't save anybody. I was just there on a dark day for folks. I didn't rush into a burning building and pull them out. But I don't want to be a trigger for anyone. So I will tell them, hey, I'm happy to talk with you at any time if you have any questions or something. And here's my office phone number. But very few people would take me up on that. And I'm totally fine with it, because I would not want to be reminded of that day if it was my darkest day. I would definitely want to give thanks to the individuals who helped me. But that could also be a trigger, you know, triggering event for them too.
Mm-hmm. So what was the defining moment for you when you started to want to help those with mental illness and suicide prevention? Because, you know, talking to over 200 people who've been in this situation, and now you're doing more after your police career has sunsetted. What is there one specific moment that did that for you?
For me, I believe it's looking into people's eyes that were over the rail on that bridge, standing on that cord that we call it C-H-O-R-D, the look in their eyes, it's almost they want to come back over, they want to live, but they can't see how they've lost all hope. It's just really, really, it sticks in your head as something that, how could you not want to help these folks? So, you know, and I've seen that many, many, many times. And every single time it's the same almost for these people that, there's a piece of them that wants to live, but they just don't see how, and they're in so much pain, so much emotional pain, that how can we get past this and get you through this crisis and moving on to another day? So that's what drives me.
Now, after seeing so many hard situations, seeing death and critical incidents, did you have a struggle with your own personal mental health?
I did, and I didn't even realize it. Be honest with you, I suffered for quite a long time. So like I said before, I did have the cancer. We look at causes of effect, causes of mental illness, and I had several of those, but I had suicide in my family. My grandfather lost his life to suicide. My mother died when she was just 49 years old. I believe I was 25, something right around there at the time. She had cancer and died, but just 49 years old. And I had some head injuries, which occurred from the motorcycle, traumatic brain injuries and things like that. And I went through a divorce where my ex-wife wrote a suicide note to each of my young boys, two boys, and was looking up on the computer how to load a gun. So I had all these things that I had kind of battled with in my life. And I didn't see the mental illness creep up on me. And what happened was I could go to work and function at 100%. I'd be fine. When I went home, I found that I didn't want to do a thing. I could sit on a couch for days. And this went on for a very, very long time. And I didn't pick up on it until I really, really thought about things. I go, you know what? How can I go to work and be great and function at 100%? But when I come home, I don't want to do a thing. All I want to do is just sit here. So finally, I told my doctor about it, my general practitioner. And he diagnosed me with depression. But it was a little bit humorous. It's not great, but the way he approached this, he walked into the room. He goes, "Kevin, I had filled out this little questionnaire before I went into the room." And I go into the room, and then he walks in and he goes, "Kevin, you have depression. How do you feel about that?" And in my mind, I'm like, "Well, what the hell? How do you think I feel about this? All this other crap, testicular cancer, mom dying, head injuries, all this divorce, everything else. And now depression. How do you think I feel about this? Come on." So plus I forgot the another one. There's too many. I had 3 stents in my heart. I think I was 47 or 48. Wow. And I had some heart issues. So I'm getting all this stuff done now. If I could make it till 60, then I think I'm going to be clean.
Wow.
But I tell folks, out of all of this stuff, and we knew my mom was dying, that was a big impact. But I think for me personally, out of all of the stuff I've been involved in, that depression took its toll on me the worst. And that's what I try to drive that point home, is you don't have to. There's therapy, there's medications. You know, there's a lot of different things that we can try and we can do to help folks feel better.
Was there one specific modality that you felt worked better for you?
A big one for me was not really the medication so much. And I did have some trauma that I just am not ready to talk about yet. But I did tell a psychiatrist, and I went through some therapy called eye movement desensitization. And the lady that did this, the mental health professional, said, "We're going to go through these sessions. And what I want to do is get this image in your head that doesn't go away." She goes, "I can't remove that. But what we can try to do is get that image that haunts you in your sleep when you're trying to sleep and it's 2 inches from your head. I want to get it way out there, like a football field away, so you can have some peace." And I opened my mind. I took this type A conservative cop and kind of, okay, just let things go. Let's calm down. Let's see what happens. So once I started opening my mind and just let things go, take it for what they are, that really helped. So that eye movement desensitization really helped me.
We love EMDR on this podcast. We talk about EMDR a lot. We talk to a lot of veterans, and that seems to be the utmost number one recommended form of help for trauma that has come up. So I'm glad that you said that. So as far as coming from, started out your life as a civilian, and then you went to the military and became a soldier, and then you came out and you're a sworn peace officer. Do you find that mental health is different for first responders, military, or people in the helping professions versus a civilian mental health issue?
I think so, because one, what you see or what you may see as a soldier or a peace officer, a fireman or something, a first responder, you're going to see things that normal people in regular jobs are not going to see. Things that that none of us should see, horrific things that we're not meant to see, but they stick in your head and they don't go away. So I think the need for that and the need for mental health professionals who deal specifically with soldiers or first responders is in great need. Now, to get soldiers and first responders to accept that, you know, years ago, very few people that I knew would ever go into therapy. They wouldn't even think about it. You suck it up, whatever you saw. If you need to hit a bar with a friend for a night or whatever you need to do, and then you get back to work and you handle it. Nowadays, it's quite different. And we have, I know we had in the Highway Patrol, what's called the EAP, Employee Assistance Program, EAP. And I would, whenever we would have a tragic incident, I would advise the officer of that. And I carried around cards, EAP cards, and I would give them to the officer and recommend it, but also follow up with them and say, "Hey, how you doing? You know, you might be experiencing these things, flashbacks, nightmares, and different things." So I think that helps them recover and it helps them get back on the job and want to continue, because most first responders, they want to do a good job, the vast majority. But sometimes they're just troubled so much that they can't continue on. And that just affects every aspect of their life. So whatever we can do, if we have to give them some time off to process all of this, I think it's fantastic that we're allowed to do this, that we should, as a sergeant, my commander, let me do this. So it helped a number of folks. And they're back on the job and they're doing the job that they want to do. They just need the time to process things.
Mm-hmm. And it's nice to see that we're becoming more progressive as a society, but also as a culture in first responding and also in the military to be a little bit more proactive and to give people more time off and to identify their needs and not just sweep it under the rug. So I think we are making some steps, but is there anything that you've learned that what is truly needed surrounding mental illness, like funding or research or just plain compassion?
All of that. I know the money is not there. For instance, in 2017, we lost over 47,000 people to suicide just in this country. Over 47,000 people, whereas we lost a little more than 17,000 to homicides and a little more than 40,000 to traffic accident fatalities, but 47,000 people to suicide. So we have a lot of work to do. And I think so much of that comes from funding and being able to recognize people who are suffering and reducing that stigma. That's a big one.
Mm-hmm. I think people are surprised when I tell them I'm a dispatcher, dispatch supervisor, and they ask, you know, what is the most calls that you get? And I ask them, well, what do you think? What kind of calls do you think we get the most calls for? They're like, oh, you know, robberies and burglaries and people with guns. And it's very sobering to them when I tell them what number one is usually domestics. And number two is usually either a person who has taken their own life or has suicidal ideations and they want help, or they have made a statement and their friend is reaching out for them. It's not the glamorous cops and robbers that people actually visualize in their head. These are the types of calls that we are seeing, and there's definitely an increase.
Right. And just like when I retired in 2013, I have had a vast increase in calls to come and present to folks about this and what we can do and what we should be doing. So, you know, you wish it would go away. I wish that 47,000 would decrease rapidly and altogether. But unfortunately, until folks recognize this and until we can have more professional help and folks want to seek and get out and get help for this, you know, there's a lot of us that think that nothing can happen to me. I was big into bodybuilding. I was in the military. I jumped out of planes. I worked at San Quentin. I was a motor sergeant. All this heavy duty, big time stuff. Nothing can happen to me. If mental illness even exists, it's a weakness for weak people. Well, I was really, really wrong. So once I started talking about it and telling people, yeah, I suffer from depression, I thought, you know, I'm going to lose friends and all sorts of stuff. No, I gained thousands and thousands and thousands of friends. I've been able to go to New Zealand and Borneo, Germany, Canada, I mean, all these places and make friends because I talk about it. And I talk about how it affected me, how it can affect them, and what can we do about it.
That's incredible. And it's nice to know and to hear that even a badass like yourself needed help because of the stigma and people not wanting to be vulnerable and to share that they are struggling. It's really nice to see someone that has so accomplished to say, hey, I was in the depths too and I sucked, but I was able to get out of it and so can you. Here's my hand.
Absolutely. That's what it takes. You do not have to do everything yourself. And we don't know everything ourselves. There's a lot of people out there that are willing to talk and to help you through these things. You just have to acknowledge it and make it come to light.
Mm-hmm. Are there any harmful misconceptions about mental illness you'd like to dispel?
You know that people, a lot of times when we watch the news, and it'll be something bad. Somebody got robbed. Somebody got killed. A school shooting, you know, the first thing they do is they look at, oh, he must be suffering from mental illness. Well, many times they are, but there's, you know, what is that? A small percentage, very, very small percentage, even 1% of folks that do that. Most of us want to live and we want to be happy. We're just trying to figure out how. And sometimes it takes that therapy or medication or a combination of both. So if we're suffering, it's not something that's just in your head. People will say, that's all in your head. Well, where do you think it would be? In my thumb? Of course it's in my head. And lots of things like this, if we're taking a medication, it doesn't mean that we're whacked or anything else. It means that things aren't firing right in our head. We want them. We want to correct them. If I did not take chemotherapy for my cancer, I would not be here right now. It's plain and simple. You know, if folks who are battling and dealing with diabetes do not take their medication when they need to, things go bad. So this is just something else that we're trying to work on.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I totally agree. I think that someone who is struggling with a mental illness or a mental deficiency, it should be treated just as much as if you had cancer. You don't blame someone for getting cancer. Why would you blame someone for having a mental illness or an addiction?
Absolutely correct. Exactly. And that's how it is too. It's still that way where it's a hard time. It is getting better. When I go out to communities, you know, there's a lot of folks that come and they want to learn more. And I tell them, I don't care who it is that's speaking about it. Let's just raise it up, raise the question, get it out there in the open. And this is not a so-called dinner table conversation. But if we don't talk about this at some point, then things get worse. If no one had talked about AIDS many, many years ago and just let it go through, we'd lose one hell of a lot of people. But because they did, and now there's a lot of procedures and medications for it, people are living longer and longer and longer.
Mm-hmm. And one day we'll look back on this point and we'll say, I am so glad that we were able to get this out because suicide rates have dropped and mental illness is something that can be curable and suicide does not have to end these people's lives. It's not a death sentence.
Correct.
I really like how you referenced the bridge as the stage 4 bridge or...
Right. And I didn't mean that for everything. I meant that as a, for everybody, because, you know, for the vast majority of people come up to look at that bridge and it's beautiful and it's fantastic, but it does have this underlying stigma about it too, this very dark side. And mm-hmm. that is the stage 4 cancer part that I referred to. So mm-hmm. yes, you're absolutely right.
No, it's actually to me a beautiful contrast because there you have what you're looking at the tunnel as your last days. And in both illnesses, it's kind of that same thing. But luckily with suicide and even with cancer, but we can kind of pull people back from that. So that's what we're trying to do here.
Absolutely. And that's why I thank God for folks like you with this podcast so we can reach folks and talk to them.
Well, thank you. So speaking about improving our situations, can you tell us a little bit about the release model? What it is and how does it work?
Sure. This is the model I developed kind of before I left the Highway Patrol, but I elaborated a lot more on it after I left and had a little more time. But it's something I made up in talking to folks, and it's called the RELEASE model, and it's RELEASE, and it's an acronym. It starts with recognize and then engage, listen, empathy, accept, support, and encourage. And we talk about recognizing when someone may be in crisis. And I say maybe because we don't know. You know, maybe they're giving away possessions and saying things like, well, you don't have to worry about me. In a few days, I'm going to be fine. And you say, okay. And instead of checking on them, you're thinking they're going on vacation, but they're thinking about checking out altogether. Mm-hmm. And they're self-isolating. Maybe they stopped taking medications they had for a mental illness. They're stockpiling medications, a number of things. Maybe they were always clean cut and liked to go out and hang out. You guys would always go to the coffee shop, and now they're just sitting at home, actually sitting in their room all day, and they're unclean, unshaven. So a lot of different things. Maybe they're even saying goodbye. I just want to let you know that thank you for all the good times we had. You're like, what are you talking about? But recognize when someone may be in crisis, and then having that conversation, what I call the courageous conversation. And being able to have that and talk to folks. Hey, you know, man, I've been noticing some changes in you in the past couple of weeks. And that's what we're looking for is in the past couple of weeks. Is I just want to let you know, is there anything going on? And I tell folks, don't have this conversation in front of a lot of people. Do it one-on-one, not in a coffee shop, because you're asking folks. My release model, release, is really to allow folks to release all their emotion and what's been going on. But to engage them and to have that conversation and to validate what they're going through. Simple as, wow, you know, that sounds really tough, everything you've been going through. But to validate who they are and their emotions and to really listen. And I say, in a conversation of this magnitude, make it 80-20 to where you're listening 80% of the time and only speaking 20% to really find out what's going on. And then the E is for empathy, to put yourself in their shoes. I think that's more difficult than it sounds, but to see things through their eyes, put yourself in their shoes. How would you feel? If we can do that, we'll have a very good understanding or a much better understanding of how they might be feeling. And to accept them for who they are, it's not this, well, how could you do that? Why would you do that? It's more of, you know, wow. And accepting them for who they are, not trying to change them, because if these folks are in crisis, they're looking for someone to talk to who's going to accept them for who they are. And really, like I said, not try to change them. They've been having a very, very tough time. Be there for them. Listen to them. Support them. That's the S in this, is to support them on their means and maybe even help them. If you are suicidal, have that individual, you know, if they're actively suicidal, well, I'm thinking about doing something tonight. Well, what are you thinking about doing? You know, well, I was thinking of ending my life. I'll be honest with you. To be able to call mental health services or a 911, there's more and more officers that are being trained in crisis negotiation skills that can come out and help for that. And encourage folks. That's the E, the end of this. The E is for encourage. Encourage them to seek help and to offer them your help. You know, you have my telephone number. You can call me 24 hours a day. I'll be there for you. I want to let you know I'm in your corner. If we can plan something like next week, we'll meet on Tuesday, or hopefully if they have a plan and they tell you, hey, can we meet in a couple of days? And fantastic. Anytime someone's talking about the future, that's what we love to hear. So it's recognize, engage, listen, empathy, accept, support, and encourage.
I'll have to try that at work. So there is a lot of talk about suicide in certain types of media, social media and everything. And there's certain articles that say, well, if a person is suicidal, you should not say this. But then also there's articles that contradict that point and say, well, you should not say this or say something a certain way. In your experience and with over 200 people that you've touched with suicide, is there something that one should not say or avoid talking about when someone's in crisis like that?
I have four little phrases that I don't use that I think would be very, very inappropriate. And the way I remember them for myself with my poor memory, but they are, you should calm down. I understand things will get better. So, and I remember it like that. You should calm down. I understand things will get better. Mm. So instead of saying, you know what you should have done, now you slapped them in the face because they're all wrong. So instead of you should, how about have you tried would be a much better way of saying that. And as far as calm down, I saw something on the web and it said, in the history of people telling someone to calm down, has anybody ever really calmed down?
I thought that was
pretty funny. Yeah, something similar. So we know that doesn't work. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if I hear you right and I can see how angry you are or whatever that may be, to help them to understand, wow, okay, I see how much this has affected you. I understand. This one, in my opinion, slaps them in the face also. Because even though I've been through some things, maybe someone has been just through one thing. You know, maybe they were brutally abused, sexually abused as a child. I mean, that's really, really tough. So for me to say, I understand, absolutely not. I don't understand what you're going through, but I'm going to try to understand what you have been going through, and I want to let you know that I'm here for you. And the last one is, things will get better. I do not know that. I've had a mental health professional tell me this one, that in their opinion, you know, things can get better or they will get better. I don't know if they will get better. Things can get better. I hope that they do, but I know there's therapies and medications out there that can help with things. So, and there's other avenues to approach that are coming up every single day. You know, maybe you are determined that you do need a medication. Okay, well, this one didn't work right. Or maybe you need a combination or the different dosages. Or maybe you just needed some therapy and some time away from something. So there's a lot of different ways that we can battle this depression or bipolar or whatever it may be. But it's just a matter of how we talk to folks and how we approach it. But really listening to them, not comparing our stories is a big one too. Well, let me tell you about me. Let me tell you about Kevin Briggs. Mm-hmm. That's a big one. All the stuff that I've been involved in when I was talking to someone over the rail, I never brought that up because I wanted to make it about the individual, Now, if they come back and said, well, you don't know what it's like to have cancer. Well, unfortunately, I did have cancer. And what I have found that commonalities create comfort. So we can talk about that. And I still remember the drugs that they gave me, these nasty drugs, but they worked. Mm-hmm. But we can talk about that, losing our hair, getting very skinny, loss of appetite and everything else. So, and I think that that builds rapport. Anything that, that can build rapport is very, very good. But the four ones that I typically don't use are, you know, you should calm down. I understand things will get better. And I can add in there, why? Well, why'd you do that? Why'd you do it that way? That tends to place blame and shut people down.
Very good. So many good points to bring back that I can take back to work too, because it's always hard. You don't know what's going to set somebody off, but those four things are really easy to remember. And I think that more people can listen without judgment, we would have a whole lot more progress in the situation.
I think so too. I really do. Yes.
So I hear you're involved in a couple of organizations. Can you tell us a little bit about Pivotal Points?
Yes, Pivotal Points. That's an organization I started when I retired in November of 2013. And what I wanted to accomplish with this is to not only teach people how to talk to someone who may be in crisis, but to learn more about themselves and their quality of life. So, you know, I'll travel all over and I have a book out and we're looking at a TV show, but you know, all this stuff, it's just a medium to get to the person, to get deep down into them. So I want them to be able to recognize, you know what, I have been doing well and I'm not feeling well. I don't want to go to the house. I haven't left the house in 7 days. I just don't have the desire or the energy. Well, let's see if we can work on that. And it's tough. I still have bad days. It's the way it is. It's the way depression is. But I know it'll pass. It's just a matter of getting past that. So, you know, what do I need to do? Eat right and try to get enough sleep. All the things that most of us don't do, exercising, or we don't do enough. I try to stay on top of those things. It's a work in progress. I'm a work in progress, but that's my goal through Pivotal Points. So whether it's going out to a community event and speaking to a community, whether it's going to a corporate workshop and teaching active listening skills, whatever that may be, you know, law enforcement, love doing that, teaching officers, how can we approach someone who may be suffering from a mental illness as approached to someone who may not be? So what are we looking at? What are we doing? And I have learned so much in the past, those 6 years, not only about myself, but about other people. I continue to learn. I continue to go to big seminars and conventions to learn more. It's been a hell of a lot of work, to be honest with you, but it's been a joy and it is my passion.
Well, that's very excellent. And I have this question for me just because I'm personally interested in it. I hear that you do a lot of public speaking. What do you love about it? And do you have any pointers for those who would like to foray into this arena?
Public speaking is tough. I don't know if I love it. People will tell you, you learn growing up, put yourself in uncomfortable positions to grow. So when people ask me a question or something similar to this, I tell them, when I'm on stage, I'm about 20 feet tall because I'm growing a lot because it's very uncomfortable. What gets me through this, and it's not going to work for everybody, of course, but I think what really helps me is I believe, truly believe in what I'm talking about. I have a lot of stories that I tell. People like stories. Now, I warn you, though, don't make things up, you know, stories that have actually happened to you that have points to them. So I always tell folks, this is not the Kevin Briggs Show. Yeah, I may tell stories, but they're all going to have takeaways of things that I learned or things that may be beneficial to you. I'm really big on that. If I get up to an audience and speak for an hour or two and they don't have any takeaways, I think it was a disservice. Why would you come to listen to someone talk on suicide prevention or active listening skills or quality of life and not have things that you can take away and, you know, do for yourself or do unto others, so to speak, help others. So that's a big one. And I would say if you wanted to get into public speaking, it's a very tough business. Do maybe some classes on public speaking. I did that. Record yourself and look at yourself and your mannerisms. And I be honest with you, I hate watching myself.
Mm-hmm.
When I do this, I did a TED talk years ago. I was part of TED 2014, I think. And I still have not watched that. I just don't like to watch myself. I've watched parts of videos and things. Okay, I got to do this because I want to learn how to be better. Am I standing up straight? Am I walking too much? Am I speaking too fast? Am I stumbling through things? But I think that's a great way of doing it. And, you know, to go for a cause, what are you passionate about? Whether that's math, whether that's religion, whether that's pet care, whatever it is, find out as much as you can about it. Be truthful. Have some stories. People love stories. They love to put themselves into the scene. And for me, I like visuals. So when I talk about folks on the bridge, if I have a picture of them, I'm going to show that picture. And I talk about my little boy who was suicidal at one point. He is 18 years old now, but a few years ago, he was suicidal. And I put up a picture of him. Here he is. I want you to see Kevin Briggs Jr. and what he looks like and who he is. So I bring as much personal stuff to the story that I can, and always keeping it real.
I'm so glad you mentioned stories because I love stories. And our series is called Power of a Story. After 23 years in law enforcement and your time in the military, is there a quick, funny story that you can share with us? And if not a funny story, is there a quick favorite story that you like to share that you can tell us?
You know, I had so many little things that would come up and then you'd forget them and all, but... you know, one of my favorites is Kevin Berthia, the African-American man who was over the rail. And I spoke with him for an hour and a half, and he was only wearing a t-shirt and a pair of shorts. I talked about him briefly during this podcast, but we spoke about his life all through. When he was a child, he was adopted, and his birth mother wanted nothing to do with him, and about his adopted parents who loved him very much, divorced. But you know, we spoke, and this, the point to this is our listening skills. So we spoke, I'm going to say we did, for 90 minutes, a little over 90 minutes. But out of that whole time, I spoke maybe 4 or 5 minutes. He spoke that entire time. And he talked about going to high school and wanting to start a family, you know, and then losing his job. And he had a baby who he loved very much, but his child was born premature and had to stay in the hospital. And when his baby came home, so did a bill for well over $200,000.
Oh, wow.
And all this trauma in his life. And he thought he did this. How did he really blow it with his child that his child had to stay in the hospital and he couldn't hold a job and he wasn't doing anything right? But in the end of it, after all of this, he decided on his own, because he had that opportunity to vent, he decided on his own to come back over that rail. And now, not only is he successful, but he gets to come out on occasion and talk to folks. And a few times every year, we get to go on stage together, and it's really, really cool. I think we crossed so many barriers. He's a fascinating guy, and it was a lot of fun to do that with him now. A very, very scary scene at the time. Mm-hmm. But, you know, he came back over, and all he told me was that you listened. You let me speak, and you listened. So instead of making this Kevin Briggs agenda, it's not. It's about that individual. So, and when I talk to negotiators, I just did a larger FBI conference with a lot of prosecutors and things back east. And we talked about this for a while. And when I was presenting, I go, we can't make this about us. It's about them. And what can we do to help them out? And I said, the biggest thing we can do is listen. That's the biggest thing. Because when I talk to folks afterwards, they say, you know, you listening was what it was. I didn't solve anything. I wasn't even going to try. But just by being there for them is just huge in their life. So that's when I talk about this stage for cancer of a bridge on occasion, mm-hmm. is we need to get to folks now. So, you know, that's one of the better stories I get to tell. And I'm really happy to be part of it. It was quite a fascinating day.
I love that story. That's one of my favorite stories now. So where can people find out more about you, your work, your book, having you speak? Where can we find all of these gems?
Sure. Well, the book is on Amazon, or you can order it through your local bookstore. It's called Guardian of the Golden Gate, Protecting the Line Between Hope and Despair. And I will tell you, I'm not a super big fan of the moniker of Guardian of the Golden Gate. I think there's many guardians of many Golden Gates. It doesn't even have to be a bridge. But the publishers generally have last say in the course. You got to look at sales and things. But I like people to know that, because ego has no place in negotiations. And that's really what this is about. And the book is about my life and how I helped others, and then how we can help other folks. And of course, the release model's in there, and some other tools for folks. So I have that. And my, if you just punched in Kevin Briggs on the computer, you'll come up with some things. And also I have my website, Pivotal Points, so www.pivotal-points.com, and that will go to my website. And we're trying to update that as best as we can and keep things flowing. But if they're interested in having me speak, you can contact me through that, or Kevin Briggs at pivotal-points.com. And I'll be happy to speak with you, or send an email out and show you the different things that I talk about. So it's been a very much a blessing, a lot of work, but it's been a really neat road to go down.
That's awesome. And I'll also put all those links and your contact information on your profile page on our website at youroxygenmaskfirst.com. So if people just want to quickly, they can just click on it, or they can click on the link to Amazon to find your book. Now, our time is coming to a close. I'm very sad because I could talk to you for hours, but do you have any closing thoughts that you would like to part with?
You know, my mantra is listen to understand. And we've talked about that time and time again with this, but it is so important. And whether you're listening to understand at a very crucial time in someone's life where they may be in crisis and talking about suicide, or maybe you're just trying to get your kids to do their homework, by listening to try and understand what they're going through can really, really help whatever situation that you're in. By blowing up and going off handle, you know, that never does us any good. But by taking the time and settling down and listening to what folks say, because we speak at about 150 words a minute, but we hear at about 450 words a minute. So what are we doing in that meantime when someone's talking? We're thinking about all the things we have to do and want to do and what we're going to say. But by trying to take in each and every word, I think we can make a big difference in people's lives.
Well, you've left me speechless, Kevin. I really appreciate it. Thank you so much for coming on our show. And I look forward to seeing all the amazing things that you have in your future and all the things that you continue to do.
Well, thank you very much for having me on your show. It's an absolute pleasure.
Thank you so much for taking the time to listen today. And I hope that you found something that really resonates with you. I can't wait to share even more. So please subscribe to the podcast, and you can find links to our resources in the description and at youroxygenmaskfirst.com.